Good evening. Venerable Chodron is still traveling through Asia. I think she's still in Singapore. And she'll be back on Friday. Thursday? The 20th. What day is the 20th? Thursday. Okay, good. But she won't be sitting in this chair on Thursday. Chances are good. Okay, so let's continue with our review, and we'll start with our motivation. Last week, Dan Perdue was advising us to pay attention to the scheme of categorizing phenomena, just noticing things as they come to our mind, as we encounter them with our senses. So, for example, when seeing a visible form with the eye, we can distinguish the eye, or the eye sense faculty is operating. And there's an object, a visible form, that's a condition. There's the action of seeing. And there's a new consciousness that is knowing. And so with some mindfulness, we notice how new consciousnesses come into being dependently. And so it's the same with the other sense functions, noticing when smelling a pleasant natural odor, noticing hearing a sound caused by elements conjoined with consciousness, noticing the observing of primary and secondary colors, noticing smoothness or roughness of a tangible object. And so as we focus on noticing, maybe labeling external appearances, this is for the sake of increasing mindfulness and inquiry. And as Mahasi Sayadaw reminds us, the purpose is to train our minds. He says, because in each act of noticing, the meditator comes to know analytically the mental process of noticing and those of thinking and reflecting, knowing for him or herself through direct knowledge of experience. And so as we do this, as we pay attention, as we increase our mindfulness, then naturally we come to know anicca, dukkha, anatta, impermanence, unsatisfactoriness, and no self. So this is a process of vipassana. And through this, through these methods, through this paying attention, this mindfulness, we can come to know more about the four aspects of the truth of suffering: impermanence, dukkha, empty and selfless. And this helps us to overcome the four distortions which get us into all sorts of trouble and keep us caught in samsara. So let's continue studying, building up our intellectual knowledge, as well as taking this into our meditation time, as well as into our daily lives, so that we can continue propelling ourselves along the path to full awakening, so that we can be of greater benefit to all beings. For me, a penny dropped last Friday when Venerable Chinni was doing the review on the four aspects of true suffering. And because it was on the heels of the Thursday night class, it just seemed like that knowledge, that basis of knowledge kind of went together, you know, and I could see more of its applicability. I don't know if that happened for you, but it has a lot of potential. Okay, so tonight we're picking up with chapter 11, called The Paradigm for Proving a Comparison of Phenomena. And I just want to go back and highlight a few things from this chapter, because actually we've been using the material from this chapter with the previous chapters to look at when we compare to phenomena. We're looking at we're putting together syllogisms, reasons why something is both this and that, why it's only one and not the other, how one pervades the other. We're using syllogisms as well as our comparison of phenomena that we learned in chapters 4 and 6. In chapter 11, Daniel Perdue sets out 6 paradigms for comparisons: mutually exclusive, mutually inclusive, and then 2 each for 3P and 4P, or 3 possibilities. We have a lot of shorthand here. 3 possibilities and 4 possibilities. Because sometimes when we compare 2 things and there are 3 possibilities, we can't find something that's neither. The 4 possibilities include, when we look at two existent things, we can find something. Can we find something that is both? It fits in both of those categories. Can we find something that is one but not the other? The other but not the one? And is there something that's neither? So the reason that the 3 possibilities and 4 possibilities have 2 each is because sometimes there are no examples of neither. Sometimes there are. So let's get warmed up just a little bit by looking at 3 possibilities. And this is taking into consideration some of the topics we talked about last week. So how did the two compare? Internal matter and a physical sense faculty. Internal matter and a physical sense faculty. I already said it was 3P. Yes, okay. Okay, so if someone asks us that question in a debate, you know, how do the two compare, then we would say there are 3P between internal matter and sense faculty. There are 3P. Three possibilities. Yeah, probably 3 possibilities. And then the person who's challenging you will say, well, posit those 3. Okay, so we're kind of in the habit of going ahead and giving the answer 3P. The way it's explained in chapter 11, it looks like you give the full answer 3P, and you know, you give an example of something that's both, and then the reasons why it's the first one and the second one. But in the debate format, then you just say 3P, and then, or 3 possibilities, and then the challenger would say, well, posit those 3. And you'd say the subject both, one but not the other, and neither. Okay? And then, so then the challenger would say, well, posit something that's both internal matter and physical sense faculty.
There is something, the subject, the ear sense power.
The ear sense power, I think Venerable prefers faculty. Did you get that?
Yes. Sorry, ear sense faculty.
Ear sense faculty, okay. The subject, ear sense faculty, is internal matter because?
Because it, roughly speaking, because it is atomically established and it is conjoined with a being. It's a person. It's the inside stuff of a person.
Included in the continuum of a person. Very good. So, yeah, it follows that the subject, the ear sense faculty is that which is atomically established and is included in the continuum of person.
Except.
Or actually, it is internal matter because it is atomically established. And yeah, okay, good. All right. And an ear sense faculty is a physical sense faculty because? Well, there's a physical sense faculty. We could just say sense faculty, and that's usually how it's seen in the text if we're generally talking about the 5 physical sense faculties. But we can compare, when we talk about mental sense faculties, they're also sense faculties. So if we say physical, then they're associated with 5 sense consciousnesses.
So physical, the ear sense faculty is a what?
Physical sense faculty.
Physical sense faculty because it is the uncommon condition, the uncommon empowering condition for an ear, an audio consciousness.
Very good.
Something like that.
Okay, so it follows that the ear sense consciousness is a physical sense consciousness because it is the uncommon empowering condition for the auditory consciousness.
Yeah.
Okay, good. All right, which which way does the pervasion go with those 2? We're talking about internal matter and a physical sense faculty. Which way does the pervasion go? So 3P, when we look at something that's 3P, then we're only going to find that one is the other, but the other is not the one. So there's a pervasion. So which way does the pervasion go? What is the larger category pervading the smaller category? Internal matter pervades the physical sense faculty. Okay? So whatever is a sense faculty is necessarily internal matter, but whatever is internal matter is not necessarily a physical sense faculty. Okay? Posit an example. So when I say that, that means posit an example that is the exception. What is something that is internal matter that's not a physical sense faculty?
It's faculty.
Is that internal matter? What is the mental sense faculty?
An internal, a subtle internal form.
Mental sense faculty. Any of the six consciousnesses, right?
Yes, any of the six.
Yes, yes. Okay, yes. Consciousness. Okay, and consciousness and matter are mutually exclusive.
Yes.
Yeah, there you go. Okay. So we said that mainly internal matter included the five sense faculties, but we also saw that there was this broader description of internal matter, right?
My liver.
Your liver. Yeah, okay. So Venerable Losang's liver is an example of something that is internal matter, but is not a physical sense faculty, right? It's internal matter because, give him a microphone, please. Let's talk about your liver. It's internal matter because?
It's internal matter because it is atomically established and included in a continuum of a sentient being, of a being.
Of a person?
A person.
Uh-huh. And it's your liver is not a physical sense faculty because?
It is not an uncommon empowering condition for a sense consciousness.
Right. Okay. Could it be an empowering condition for any sense consciousness? What about a doctor doing surgery on your liver?
But it wouldn't be an uncommon. I'm not sure if it would be a...
I think we'd have to tighten that up just a little bit by saying the liver in my body... Like, not under, I don't know. How would you tighten that up?
Well, I said it's not the...
Under normal conditions, maybe.
The uncommon empowering condition.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Oh, I'm sorry. Right. You're right. Yeah.
Would the liver be internal matter? Because I thought it was elaborated in the bigger debate book that internal matter is part of the sensate part of the body. And is the liver... Do we have feeling there?
You can certainly feel your liver.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Internal matter refers mainly to mm-hmm. the five sense faculty.
Right, mainly. So that leaves a little door open for something else, doesn't it? Internal. Yeah. Yeah, right. You were supporting. Okay, good. Okay, and then posit something that is neither internal matter nor a sense faculty. This is where your answer would come in. Venerable Nima. We're ready for your answer now.
Posit something that is neither
internal matter nor a sense faculty, a physical sense faculty.
Internal matter, not a physical sense faculty. So it would be a tangible object.
That's, I think, a little too broad, because tangible objects, like we can touch a liver.
Oh, I could say the Venerable Sepal's iMac computer.
Okay. Yeah, that's not internal matter, and it's not a sense faculty. I was thinking more of your answer, a mental sense faculty. Mental sense faculty is not internal matter because it's not matter, and it's not a physical sense faculty because it's a mental sense faculty. Yeah, but either one would do. Either one is good.
Liver and onions.
Liver and onions. Take a microphone. If you're gonna talk, share it with everybody.
I said liver and onions because a liver that is no longer part of the continuum
of a person. Once it's out of the body, it's no longer included in the continuum of a person.
Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah.
Okay, liver and onions. I haven't had that for a few decades. But okay. Mm.
It would have to be liver and onions that have not yet been eaten.
Touché. Or digested. Okay. Good. This is how we sharpen our minds. Okay, so this is a process that we've actually done a number of times. And the reason I picked those two topics is because we studied them last week. Probably the definitions are a little shaky in the mind, right? Unless you've really been drilling on them, reciting malas of definitions at night before you go to bed. You've been doing that, Venerable? Never mind. Okay.
Is that what you do?
Sometimes if I'm really trying to memorize something, then I will say it a number of times. Probably not a whole mala, probably not 108, but I will repeat it again and again. And that right before bed and then right again in the morning is a good way to memorize. If you're really trying to get something to, if you're developing a deeper imprint in the mind, that's a good time to do it. Yeah. Okay. So someone describe for me how going through the process with four possibilities would be different. Some things would be the same, right? And some things would be different. So who can describe those? Venerable Lamsa?
Well, you wouldn't ask which way does the pervasion go. Mm-hmm. You'd be giving examples of one but not the other for both of the two objects or phenomena that we're trying to compare. Mm-hmm. That would be the main distinction.
Yeah. So you'd always include both and neither. Well, possibly neither. And then... one, not two, two, not one. Yeah. Okay. And then what about mutually exclusive? How do these two compare? An eye sense faculty and a visual consciousness. I gave you a clue. They're mutually exclusive. Right. Why are they mutually exclusive? They're mutually exclusive because?
They're mutually exclusive because they are different, but that's not the right word. Because they are diverse, and because whatever is a, what are we talking about? A visual sense consciousness?
Eye sense faculty and visual consciousness.
Yeah, eye sense faculty is necessarily not a visual, because it is a matter, it is subtle matter, and the visual consciousness is necessarily not the eye sense faculty, because it is a consciousness.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so you're giving a specific answer for this. In general, we can say two things are mutually exclusive if they meet two criteria. One is that they are diverse. They are diverse phenomena, right? Or they are phenomena that are diverse. Yeah, that's the definition of different, and we'll come to that in a later chapter, but he's introducing it here. That's mutually inclusive. But no, you were right on it here when you said, and there's nothing that's both. You can't find anything that's both. If it's one, it's not the other, necessarily. And so actually that first point, that they are diverse phenomena, is true of all the different combinations, the six combinations that we have. We can only compare two diverse phenomena. You wouldn't compare something with itself. What's the point? It's the same. It's one. And they need to be phenomena. They need to be existence. But with mutually exclusive, then whatever is one is not the other, or is that there is nothing that is both. So as you said, the subject and eye sense faculty is necessarily not a visual consciousness, because it's not matter. It's not an uncommon empowering condition. There are many ways you could answer that. Yeah. And the same with the visual consciousness. It's necessarily not an eye sense faculty for various reasons. Okay. All right, and then mutually inclusive. How do the two compare? Functioning thing and impermanent phenomena. Mutually inclusive. Why are they mutually inclusive?
Or phenomena that are diverse and they share the eight doors of pervasion.
Right. So they're phenomena that are diverse and they share the eight doors of pervasion. Can you run through those eight doors quickly? Do you remember them? Without reading?
Whatever is, P is necessarily a Q. Whatever is a Q is necessarily a P. Whatever is not a P is necessarily not a Q. Whatever is not a Q is necessarily not a P. Something about exists.
If P exists,
then Q necessarily exists. If Q exists, P necessarily exists. If P does not exist, Q necessarily does not exist. If Q does not exist, P does necessarily not exist.
Excellent. Okay, so for two things to be mutually inclusive, then they need to be diverse phenomena that are diverse, and they need to share the eight doors of pervasion. So we learned previously that a definition and its definiendum always share the eight doors of pervasion. Also, things that are equivalent, terms that are equivalent, share the eight doors of pervasion. Also, we found that, like for instance, we had eight synonyms and eight terms that all meant existent. They were referring to things that exist, right? And each one of those definiendums was also shared eight doors of pervasion with every one of the definitions of those eight equivalents.
Does that mean that anything that is equivalent, any number of phenomena that are equivalent share, that their definitions of each of these phenomena are also equivalent?
I guess so.
They all share eight doors of pervasion. So there's any phenomena that are equivalent.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah, because the definiendums are synonymous. I think we can use that term. They're equivalent. And so their definitions are going to be equivalent as well. So you can mix and match. What were you saying? 16? Wouldn't it be more than 16? 64. Yeah, wouldn't it be 8 squared? Like, you could have existent, and then that's share eight doors of pervasion with all eight.
Yeah.
And then the next one, existent, 8 by 8. Okay, 64. Yeah, a bunch. Okay. Then there's that wonderful exercise, 11.1, that we did a couple of times, and so we don't need to go over that again. But just to keep that in mind, on page 212, that we have those 20... pairs to look at and to go through the different pervasions and to really spell them out. And actually, it might be good to go back through them again at some point and wait for the other person to ask the questions instead of giving all the rundown of how it's both and one not the other and neither all at once. Does that make sense? Okay. Any questions about that? Anything else you'd like to talk about there? Okay, that brings us up to chapter 12, consciousness in relation to what they perceive. Consciousnesses in relation to what they perceive. In the second paragraph on that, for the first page of the chapter, page 215, Dan Perdue makes two statements that I think are worth repeating. He says, the Buddhist description of what exists is of little value if one does not reflect on those descriptions. In a way, it is easy to reflect on the nature of our mind because it is always with us, so we can do it anytime, anywhere. In another way, it's difficult because the mind is always with us, and it's hard to pay attention to when it's always there. Both are true, aren't they? But this is a big part of our practice, to always be checking. What's the mind doing? What's the flavor of the mind? What's the mind focused on? Is the mind positive? Is the mind negative? Is it neutral? And so when we pay attention to objects and what our mind is attracted to, what the attention is or intention is moving our mind towards, we have a better chance of investigating and discriminating. You know, is this something I should be paying attention to? Or if I pay attention to this, is it going to turn into distorted attention very easily and quickly turn into attachment, something I need to turn away from? And the same with aversion. So that was one thing that caught my eye. The other is, he says, the Buddhists offer detailed descriptions of sense and mental consciousnesses that are geared mainly towards weighing the value of those consciousnesses in accurately engaging their objects. Thus, they can have real value for all persons who care to measure the reliability of their thoughts and perceptions. Don't you love that? So we are people who care to measure the reliability of our thoughts and our perceptions. Why? Because the more accurate our thoughts and perceptions are, the more we're in touch with reality. And I love that saying, we only suffer when we're out of touch with reality. Unfortunately, we don't realize just how often we are out of touch with reality. Anytime there's an affliction at work, we are out of touch with reality and we are bound to suffer. So this is worthwhile for us. All right, so there on the bottom of that page, we have the definition of consciousness, that which is clear and knowing, or clear and cognizant. Venerable prefers that word. And just a reminder that consciousness has two synonyms that we found earlier in the text, awareness and knower. In fact, knower is the definition of awareness. So those three are, actually those four, consciousness and its definition, as well as awareness and knower. Those are all, those share the eight doors of pervasion. Those are all synonymous. Equivalent. Yeah. Equivalent is a safer word. I don't quite understand that yet, so need to clarify. All right, so we could ask, how do the two compare, knower and that which is clear and cognizant? Mutually inclusive because?
Diverse phenomenon, and whatever is a knower is necessarily clear and cognizant, and whatever is clear and cognizant is necessarily a knower.
Yeah, or that's one way to answer it. You can also just say they share the eight doors of pervasion, or I think he uses the word approaches, eight approaches of pervasion. I learned it as eight doors, so that's what comes out of my mouth quickly. Okay. All right, and then how do the two compare, awareness and mental consciousness? So now we're getting into the divisions of awareness or consciousness. So awareness and mental consciousness, how do those two compare? 3P? What's that?
In the book he says 3P.
Right, 3P. Okay, so which way does the pervasion go? Venerable Somten. Okay, so awareness and mental consciousness, they're 3P, three possibilities. That means there is something that is both. And then there's going to be one but not the other. So we're looking to see which way does the pervasion go? What pervades what? You can say the larger, whatever it is, the larger category pervades the smaller category. So of those two, awareness would be the larger category, wouldn't it?
Okay.
Okay. So we'd say whatever is a mental consciousness is an awareness, but whatever is an awareness is not necessarily a mental consciousness. For example, a sense consciousness. Right. Right. Okay. So awareness or consciousness or knower, those can all be divided. The basic division would be sense consciousness is a mental consciousness. Okay. So the Sutra school makes a really big distinction between thought consciousness and direct perceiver. In fact, they say that these two are mutually exclusive. Now, if you think back to Venerable's teachings on foundation of Buddha thought, or foundation of Buddhist practice, the consequent school has a different take on that. So you might want to take another look at that in your text, but here in the Sutra school, they say that thought consciousness and direct perceivers are mutually exclusive. Whatever is one is not the other. They are diverse phenomena, and whatever is one is necessarily not the other. They say that all conceptual consciousnesses are mistaken with respect to what? Which object? The appearing object, right. That's right, because what appears to a mental consciousness, wait, that's not entirely true. A thought consciousness, there we go. Whatever appears to a thought consciousness is only an image of which serves to represent what it understands, but it's not the actual object. So this reflects the distinction. I like this point. It reflects the distinction between ultimate truths and conventional truths in this system. interesting to think about, because they have a really unusual take on ultimate truths, truths that are known by an ultimate awareness, in other words, a direct perceiver. they see those as ultimate awarenesses. Okay. So just a quick review. Do you remember what is ultimate truth mutually inclusive with for the Sutra School? Do you remember those different equivalents?
Impermanent
phenomena. What else? Functioning thing. What else? Product. Specifically characterized phenomena. Good. Two more. Well, a few more. Compounded or composed phenomena. That which disintegrates. Disintegrating phenomena. And use manifest phenomena. Right. There are also a couple of extra ones. Do you remember? Cause and effect and condition. We could add a condition as well. Okay, good. It's good to just review those periodically to make those imprints a little deeper. Okay, so why are ultimate truths ultimate for this school? Because they may be known by an ultimate awareness, a direct perceiver, that observes its object exactly as it is. Well, so they say. Because for them, these impermanent phenomena are truly existent. They exist as they appear. So how do these two compare? Thought consciousness and conceptual consciousness. Mutually inclusive. Okay? And how do these two compare? Thought consciousness and mental consciousness. 3P. And which way does the pervasion go?
Whatever is a thought consciousness is necessarily a mental consciousness, but whatever is a mental consciousness is not necessarily a thought consciousness. For example, a yogic direct perceiver.
Good. Yeah. And then we could follow up. A yogic direct perceiver is a mental consciousness because?
Because it is a knower that's produced in dependence upon its own uncommon empowering condition, a mental sense faculty.
Yes. And it's not a thought consciousness because?
Because it does not rely on an image as it's in order to apprehend the object.
Yes, and what's that term that Venerable Children likes us to use for image?
conceptual appearance.
Yeah, it doesn't rely on a conceptual appearance to know its object. Good, excellent. Okay, and then how do these two compare? Conceptual consciousness and mental consciousness. 3P. Yeah, we're just trying to get facile with these terms so that immediately something appears in your mind. Since since conceptual consciousness and thought consciousness are equivalent, yeah, then they're going to have the same relationship with mental consciousness. So just get a really clear image in your mind that mental consciousness is the bigger category because it can include direct perceivers and thought consciousnesses. Right. Then the definition of conceptual consciousness, that's kind of a tough one, but I bet it can be posited. You can even read it if you needed to. Conceptual consciousness is defined as?
Conceptual consciousness is defined as a determinative knower that finds, I don't know, it allows for a conceptual appearance and a sound generality as suitable to be mixed.
Yeah.
I don't have the words exactly.
That's
right.
It's, you got the meaning. Yeah. She doesn't like that word, apprehends. Okay, we could say perceives. Determinative knower that apprehends a sound generality and a conceptual appearance. You're interjecting that there as suitable to be mixed. And it's really nice the way he breaks that down on the bottom of page 217. He gives us a step-by-step breakdown of the definition. So it's a determinative knower. This is an important term to know because it comes up in some of the definitions like of inferential cognition, I think. So a determinative knower means a conceptual consciousness determines that an object is such and such. It's determining what is this object. So such a consciousness thinks this is such and such. It's determining what this object is. So we might see something with an eye consciousness, a visual consciousness, but the visual consciousness, as we'll get into, it may understand that what it's seeing is a person, may even understand that what it's seeing is one's father or mother, but it's not labeling, it's not determining like a conceptual consciousness would.
How does a determinative knower compare to the aggregate of
discrimination?
Like what's, which kind of does the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's a mental factor, but
yeah. Right. It's an omnipresent mental factor, so it's accompanying every consciousness. Is that why you're wondering?
Yeah, well, I mean, the description of what it, of its function, what it does, is very similar to this. And so I'm like, well, what's the difference, or what's the distinction between the two?
Yeah. Yeah, I think this goes right into the difficulty of this section when it starts describing like how a sense consciousness can know father. And I looked through the books I had and I couldn't find anything further than the fact that Dan Perdue relies on Lodi Rinpoche's text and repeats what he has said there. So I think we're kind of up against the wall there until we can ask someone who has studied Yuksha's outside of the Drepung Losling school to see if there's another take, say in Sarah J or Sarah May or the Ganden tradition. I don't know. Yeah, but it's an interesting question. All consciousnesses are determinative in the sense of knowing the unique features of the object. That's what discrimination is doing. It's knowing the unique characteristics or features. So it sounds like, or it seems like, what I would guess, this is my guess, is that a determinative knower is actually doing something like assessing or labeling or categorizing or... Yes, that's another distinction. It's necessarily using a generic image. It's conceptual, whereas a determinative knower will accompany every consciousness. So... Discrimination, yeah, that's what I meant to say. Discrimination, the mental factor, discrimination accompanies, it's omnipresent, so it's accompanying every consciousness. Yeah, it's interesting to think about. It might be more subtle in the work that it's doing. You know, it really brings out the fact that a sense consciousness is not just a dumb knower of raw data, but rather it's a knower. It's engaging that object in a cognizant. It's cognizing something. It's active, you know? Active mental moment. Yes, it also can know something about function, as we've seen. Yeah. Okay. So, thank you for that question. Sound generality, that's the next term in that. So a determinative knower that apprehends a sound generality, I think it should say, or and or a meaning generality, but it's the potential. It has the potential for apprehending a sound generality and a meaning generality. So the sound generality is a generalized conceptual image that you get based on the sound of the name. That's how he describes it here. Doesn't that sound like a meaning generality as well? It's a generalized conceptual image that you get based on the sound of a name. So you may not know what the meaning is, but you still get an image. Like when we first are learning about emptiness, we might go, huh? But something probably unclear appears in our mind, even if we don't know the meaning. If we hear a sound, a term, then we will have an image associated with that. Okay. And then a meaning generality, or as you were pointing out, it's really equivalent with what we are using is in terms of a conceptual appearance. It's a generalized conceptual image of something that you have previously met with. And I would add, you may or may not know the name. But couldn't you have a conceptual consciousness? Won't you have a conceptual consciousness if you only know the name of something and you don't know what it means? And if you only know the meaning of something and you don't yet know its name, won't you have a conceptual consciousness?
But a determinative knower is more than a conceptual consciousness.
No, this is the definition of conceptual consciousness.
Right. It's a determinative knower, but it's doing something.
Yeah,
it's, but it has to be doing both of those.
Why?
Because you're saying it's such and such. So you have to have, this is how I would understand this.
Uh-huh.
It's always described as, that it's determining this is such and such. So to do that, you need a label, so a term, which would be the sound generality, mm-hmm. and you need to know what the heck it is, which is like the conceptual appearance. And so the two are suitable to be mixed.
Okay, so say you see something for the first time and you don't have a name for it, and you go, look at that thingamabob. Isn't that or you think about it, okay, to have a conceptual mind. What was that thingamabob I saw the other day? I don't know what it was. Isn't that a conceptual mind?
Yeah, it is a conceptual mind.
Okay. So it seems like you don't yet have a term for it. You don't have a sound generality.
I see what you're saying there. But you are adding some kind of label. You're just adding your own.
It's true. It's true. Okay.
What about a baby who doesn't have that language still has conceptual understandings of things?
Good point.
Okay, I see your point now.
Yeah, I think that's the meaning of suitable to be mixed, to tell you the truth. They are suitable to be mixed, and that would be probably the strongest conceptual consciousness we have is when we have both of those, the term of sound generality and the conceptual appearance.
I think this might
say that once they are mixed, it's hard to take them back apart. Once you know the name of something, and it's,
yeah,
they come together.
They're glued.
Yeah.
Okay. So it's interesting that we have a definition here of meaning generality of a table. I love this. That superimposed factor that appears like a table to the thought consciousness apprehending table, although it is not a table. So what it's getting at is the superimposed factor is the elimination of all that is not exactly identical with table. In other words, it's the elimination of non-table. Or sometimes you see it written as opposite of non-table. You can't put your hat on it. What does that mean? Oh, it's a table that you can't put your hat on. Because it's the opposite of non-table. So this is again highlighting how conception works, which is it eliminates everything that is other than that object. And that's how we know the object. At least that's how it's described. Okay, so thought consciousness understands table through the appearance of a meaning generality of a table, or through the conceptual appearance of a table. Though it understands its object, thought understands its object in a general way. Remember we talked a lot about looking at the striker, and you can see all the specific characteristics of the striker. And then if you close your eyes and recall it, all of a sudden there's a lot less detail. It becomes a very general understanding of that object. And he says it's not a specific table, but an image of a table in general. And I would say even if you are calling to mind like the table in the kitchen area of Ananda Hall, what comes to your mind, I think you could still say, is a general table. Because it's not that table. It's like a very generally characterized memory of that table. It doesn't have all the unique features that that table would have if we were looking at it directly. Yeah. So the meaning generality, or the conceptual appearance, is permanent, a static, unchanging, permanent phenomena. So this would be an occasional permanent phenomena. Because as he points out, the image may not last forever. I'm not sure what he means there. What are your guesses?
The first time you see a car, you might see a Volvo. And then you will have identified car at that point. But then, so when you then think about car later, the image, the generality that comes up may look something like a Volvo. But you could then see, you know, maybe you live in a land that only has Volvos. And then you go
Sweden.
To another place that has all different kinds of cars. And now when you bring up the thought of car, you might now see a V-dub. And so that now your generic image, your this is where, yeah, it has changed. So that makes it, you still have car, but what's coming to mind isn't the same. So mm-hmm. It's occasional in that way.
Okay.
Somebody, I guess, with dementia or Alzheimer's, they could forget what they previously knew. So they knew who their daughter was, but then they forgot. So mm-hmm. It's gone.
Yeah, I don't think we have to wait till dementia, actually. I forget a lot of things. What was that? It's not clear. Yeah, good point. He says, the object is understood in a generally characterized way by thought. Their character is known only in a general way by an imputing consciousness. He goes on to say that since conceptual appearances depend on imputation by thought, these imputed phenomena are therefore not established from their own side. Isn't that interesting? So it's just an interesting distinction to make. You know, we talk about how external objects are considered truly existent for the Sutra School. External objects. Well, external objects don't include permanent phenomena, do they? So permanent phenomena for this school would be imputed. They would not be truly existent. Just something to hang on to. It may come in handy one day when you're debating. So he was making the point that the object is for a thought consciousness, the object is understood in a generally characterized way. Their character is known only in a general way by an imputing consciousness. So thought consciousnesses are imputing consciousnesses.
Get into this here, but what helps me with that is when they go into that thing of like not established in time, location, and something else. Because like when you see something, you're seeing a specific thing in a specific location at a specific time, that whiteboard. Mm-hmm. But then when I think about it, I'm putting together all these things that aren't established in that way from mm-hmm. all the different whiteboards I've seen, all the different times I've seen them, all the different locations.
Interesting.
So established and abiding. I can't remember the phrase. Sorry. But it helps to me, that understanding of it helps me to understand this process in the mind. One is uh-huh. The thing is there. It's a specifically characterized phenomenon. How they call it, but what does that mean? It means it's there at this moment, at that time, looking like that. It's an establishment and abiding. I can't remember.
Okay, I haven't heard that term. Mm. Right, that's interesting.
But then when you have a generic, a conceptual appearance or a generic image of something, uh-huh. You're mixing. These things are all mixed from different locations, different times, different things, and you're just mishing it all together.
Yes, and probably not getting the sharp detail and all the nuanced characteristics. Yeah. Okay, good. Thank you. I really enjoyed that section where he talked about how some of our conceptual images are words themselves. Did you play with that a little bit? He gave a couple of examples. Notice what appears to your mind when you think something like economic inflation. I like his description. You may get snippets of TV-style imagery associated with inflation. You know, you probably see like a stock market drawing or, I don't know, what appears to your mind? Some newscaster or someone in a suit. Yeah. What was the other one? Sexism. What appears to your mind then? A woman appears to your mind. Mm-hmm. A man standing over a woman. Hmm. So now we move on to direct perceivers. Page 221. Direct perceivers are consciousnesses able to realize specifically characterized phenomena, in other words, impermanent phenomena or functioning things, products, composed phenomena, all the things that we used, all the equivalents that we pulled up earlier, together with all of its uncommon characteristics. They realize their objects directly without depending on a conceptual appearance. The actual object appears to the direct perceiver. Okay, so appears. Sound can appear, right, to an auditory consciousness. A smell can appear. Is that seem a little bit strange. Usually we're talking about visual consciousness when we use that word appear, but any of these objects can arise to their corresponding sense consciousnesses. So although some conceptual consciousnesses are reliable cognizers, like what? Like an inferential cognizer, for instance? But direct perceivers are held up by the Sutra school as the most reliable and accurate consciousnesses. Called direct perceivers because they realize their objects directly without depending on the appearance of a conceptual appearance. So for the Sutra school, direct means the object appears directly without depending on a conceptual appearance. Again, consequent school has a different understanding of that. Go check Foundations of Buddhist Practice. I don't want to confuse you, so I won't bring it up here. Okay, so what's the definition of direct perceiver here in the Sutra school? Yep, so it follows that the subject, the non-mistaken knower, that's free of conceptuality, is the definition of a direct perceiver. Okay, so a knower, again, equivalent with consciousness and awareness, clear and cognizant, non-mistaken. What does that mean here in the Sutra school? Non-mistaken with regard to their appearing object. All right, so that's what's appearing to that consciousness, the appearing object. Right, as opposed to, a direct perceiver, for a direct perceiver, yeah, there's no conceptual appearance. The appearing object is the actual object, we could say. Yeah, primarily. It's a specifically characterized phenomena that appears directly to an apprehending consciousness. It's also not mistaken with regards to its engaged object, just happens to be the case, because for a direct perceiver, the engaged object is the same as its appearing object. You remember we talked about eye consciousness apprehending blue? It's a visual consciousness apprehending blue, and so the appearing object is blue, the engaged object is blue. What does that mind understand? Blue. I don't know why they use that as the standard example, but it's the one that sticks in my mind. So that's good to just keep in mind. It's free of conceptuality. It contacts the object directly without the use of a conceptual appearance. Okay, so free conceptuality, non-mistaken. Why do you think they have both of those terms then, non-mistaken and free of conceptuality? What if it just said a non-mistaken knower? What would be the consequence of an inference could be a direct perceiver? And what if it just said knower free of conceptuality? Then you could have a visual wrong consciousness and still have a direct perceiver. So it seems like both of those elements of the definition are necessary. Okay, and he points out that we have a tendency to think of direct perceivers as synonymous with sense perception, right? Because it's non-conceptual, sense perception, non-conceptual. But how do the two compare, direct perceiver and sense perception? Direct perceiver, should we do it on the board?
Yeah.
Direct perceiver and sense perception. Direct perceiver and, what is it, sense consciousness?
Sense perception.
Sense perception. I believe that's the same as saying sense consciousness. So, as we've seen in the past, what's really helpful when we're comparing two things is to make sure we understand what's included in each of the categories. Then we can see if there's any overlap. So, what's included under direct perceivers? So now I'm asking you about the divisions, really. Yeah. Can we just leave it that general? Sense of mental consciousness? Yeah, we have sense direct perceivers and we have mental direct perceivers. And yogic direct perceivers. You know, I noticed that he also didn't include self-knower direct perceivers. So I guess this is the trend that since they're going to be, they present a lot of difficulties, but because they're in so much of the literature, like the Middle Way literature is full of talking these debates about self-knowers. So we could say, okay, we'll put it in parentheses, self-knowing direct receiver. Oops, put the whole thing in there. That's okay. All right. Anything else under direct receivers? That's pretty conclusive. We can also just keep in mind the definition, a non-mistaken knower that is free of conceptuality.
So that's all consistent with the Sutra School?
Yes. Yes, that's all consistent with the Sutra School. Yeah. What was your doubt?
My doubt was just having read over some of it, I wasn't sure if he was banging back and forth between the Sutra School and Consequence School. But I'm
because
not
he left out self-knowers, or?
No, I'm trying to find the part where I had seen that, but okay. I haven't found it.
No, I'm pretty sure that this text is, he's running Sutra School all the way through. Yeah. Okay, what about sense perception? What do we know about sense perception? It's non-conceptual. So that part's the same, isn't it? Free of conceptuality? Yeah. Okay, so we have sense direct perceivers. That's a good distinction to make. And then we also have wrong consciousnesses, non-conceptual wrong consciousnesses. We also have sense perception. Yeah. Inattentive awareness, it's called. Okay, good. All right, I think we're ready to look, to have a look. So is there something that's both a direct perceiver and a sense perception? Yeah, sense direct perceiver. And is there something that's a direct perceiver, but not a sense perception? Mental direct perceiver, for instance. Is there something that is a sense perception, but not a direct perceiver?
Non-conceptual wrong consciousness.
Yeah, non-conceptual wrong consciousness. And then what's something that is neither of these two?
Self-grasping ignorance.
Self-grasping ignorance, our friend. Well, no, not our friend. Seems like a friend, a pseudo-friend. Okay, so this would look like this. We can find something that's both, something that's one, not the other, something the other, not the one, and there is something that's neither that's outside of those two circles.
Were you saying that Venerable Danyo said that it's better to make more specific examples when we do this kind of comparison, or is it just fine to do it the way we just did it?
I think this is fine. These are, well, okay. We could even be more specific. Like, instead of saying sense direct perceiver, we could say eye consciousness apprehending blue or visual consciousness apprehending blue.
What was all the point of having to go that specific? What was the point? This seems helpful to do it this way.
Yeah. I'm trying to remember now what was the big deal there? something about instances. So here, under direct perceiver, something that is a direct perceiver but not a sense perception, by saying mental direct perceiver, that is an instance. I don't remember exactly why. I'll go back and look at the email and see if I can pull out the answer.
This might be off, take us off a little bit, but the selfless is the largest category.
Mm-hmm.
All phenomena fall under it.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, in the Sutra School, that doesn't assert selflessness of phenomena. What does that mean?
When we looked at this at the beginning of this course, there were a couple of ways to describe it. One was that there is a way of saying that all phenomena can be an object of use, or it cannot be an object of use of a self-sufficient, substantially existent self. So that's one way to understand it. There was a second way to understand it that isn't popping up in my mind right now. So that's your homework. You get to go look that up and tell us next week. Okay. Does anybody remember that? Venerable Losong? No? But I think thinking about it that way, there are no self-sufficient, substantially existent persons, and there are no objects of use of a self-sufficient, substantially existent person. That's one way you can get around it. It's cleaner if we talk about it from the consequence point of view. Everything lacks inherent existence.
Absolutely.
But given that we're talking about the Sutra school, we have to be a little more creative. I just don't remember where it is exactly in the text to put my finger on it right this minute, but we did cover that. Okay. So let's, if we look at direct perceivers, they're divided into two, sense direct perceivers and mental direct perceivers, because basically we could also include yogic and self-knowing direct perceivers under mental direct perceivers. They are mental. They rely on a, that wouldn't be the reason. I was going to say they rely on the uncommon empowering condition. It's unique. It's uncommon empowering condition, a mental sense power faculty, but actually that's not true of a yogic direct perceiver. Mental. They are both mental, but I'm not sure why. I'm looking for a reason. We haven't studied yogic direct perceivers yet, but their uncommon empowering condition is a union of calm abiding and special insight focused on selflessness or subtle impermanence. So
sort of consciousness that's not a sense consciousness.
Yeah, you could go that direction.
Just have to meet the definition of a direct perceiver that is a mental consciousness, happens to be a mental consciousness, so you could, it's a broad category. A mental direct perceiver, the definition of that, the other two would be included in.
Yeah, if we go back to the definition of a mental consciousness, it's a knower that is produced independence upon its own uncommon empowering condition, a mental sense power, and perhaps you could say, although it's a very unique uncommon empowering condition, even a union of calm abiding and special insight would be a mental sense power. It's a consciousness, right?
But you're talking about a mental consciousness, and are you saying mental consciousness and mental direct perceiver are equivalent?
No. But I was thinking, why would a yogic direct perceiver also... Okay, we're saying that direct perceivers are divided into sense and mental,
right,
and mental subsumes yogic and self-knower.
Right.
So I was just trying to explain in my mind
what I was suggesting is that because of the definition of a direct perceiver, a non-mistaken knower that's free from conceptuality, wouldn't a mental... I was thinking a mental direct perceiver would be a non-mistaken mental... what's the word? The definition of that would be broad enough to include the other two. So I was seeing it.
Yes, but we're trying to distinguish it from a sense direct perceiver. And so how would you do that? How would you make that distinction? I think you'd have to go to talking about the uncommon empowering condition.
Okay.
And like I was saying just then.
Yeah, you're right. Okay.
A union of calm abiding and special insight is a consciousness. So it would fall under the category of a mental sense faculty. It's just a very unique one. So he starts by talking about sense direct perceivers. There are five sense direct perceivers corresponding to the five sense consciousness. And again, here we find that they're produced upon the aggregation of three things: the observed object condition, the uncommon empowering condition, and the immediately preceding condition. So these are the causes for a new sense consciousness, and since a cause and effect cannot exist at the same moment, the new consciousness is posited as knowing an object which exists one moment before it. Don't you love that? It's interesting to think about. Can we know anything in the present moment? Well, there's knowing of an object, but the object doesn't exist anymore by the time we know it. It's interesting, huh? I guess it goes back to the conundrum. Can anyone actually be in the present moment? Can we actually, you know, there's so much emphasis on be in the present. You can only live in the present. But the present is this undefinable line between the past that we've experienced and the future that's unknown. So the new consciousness is posited as knowing an object which exists one moment before it. It may not seem this way to us because objects have a continuum of a similar type. But stay tuned to see what the consequent school says about this. They have a unique presentation of object and subject existing at the same time, mutually dependent. We'll get to that eventually. All right, so on page If we go back to page 193, we find the definition of a sense consciousness. That's a knower that is produced in dependence upon its own uncommon empowering condition. I don't know if it says own. I think that's from a previous definition. It does own? Okay. Its own uncommon empowering condition of physical sense faculty. So that's sense consciousness. And then we have direct perceiver, which is a non-mistaken knower that is free of conceptuality. So we could put those two together, even though it's not found in our text. We could come up with a definition of sense direct perceiver, a non-mistaken, non-conceptual knower that is produced from its own independence upon its own uncommon empowering condition, a physical sense faculty. Actually, I also found that in mine in Tibetan Buddhism. but I'm just trying to show you that there are all these building blocks that we're learning right now about consciousness. And sometimes they can sound confusing, or it can seem confusing, because how do you keep them distinguished? But if we learn these basic building blocks like sense consciousness and mental consciousness and then direct perceivers, then we can put them together so that we understand what these consciousnesses are. And since there are five sense direct perceivers, each has its own unique definition. So for instance, a sense direct perceiver apprehending a form, it's interesting that it doesn't say a visual sense direct perceiver. I suppose that's what it's meaning, but typically it's in the text, it says a sense direct perceiver apprehending form. So this is a non-mistaken, non-conceptual knower that is produced independence upon its own uncommon empowering condition, the eye sense faculty, right, and an observed object condition. So this is similar to the definition that we had of a visual consciousness, but now we're adding visual direct perceiver, you know, a sense direct perceiver apprehending form. Does that make sense? I think I got it out of Mind and Tibetan Buddhism. Yeah.
So any of the five can be apprehending form. You just use different modes of doing it.
Okay. Well, here, I guess, yeah, visual form. It should say apprehending visual form. Thank you. I love it that you catch me on these things.
But now if you're trying to come up with a channel for sense, then you don't need visual.
Well, but each one will have its own unique definition. So a sense direct perceiver apprehending visible form, a sense direct perceiver apprehending sound, you know, because the definition would change. It would be the uncommon empowering condition then would be an ear sense faculty and an auditory consciousness. Or, I'm sorry, an observed object condition of sound. Okay, so just think of all the sense direct perceivers that you've had today since you woke up. Probably quite a few, right? Different shapes and colors that we've seen all day long, different sounds we've heard, different smells. Cinnamon rolls comes to mind. or granola, actually. Different tastes at lunch, at breakfast, dinner. Different tactile objects that we've experienced. Probably into the thousands. What did you say? 70,000, who was it who's quoting? Said we have 70,000 thoughts, conceptual thoughts during the day. There are probably, many of them are probably associated with direct perceivers. We probably have a direct perceiver after each of those sense consciousnesses, direct perceivers. Because we have this tendency to label and to think about things immediately. It's probably just one or two bare moments of attention to a sense object, and then we're thinking about it. Takes us off the object. Okay, so each one of these moments that we have is an opportunity to be aware of what's happening in our mind. This is kind of like active four establishments of mindfulness, being aware of different consciousnesses as they arrive, different feelings that are associated with those consciousnesses. Different phenomena. So he makes the point that consciousnesses of all types are impermanent phenomena, changing moment to moment, and their explicit objects are also impermanent phenomena, disintegrating moment to moment. So if sense consciousnesses last only a moment and their objects too last only a moment, how is it that a sense consciousness can know anything? It's an interesting question. Do you remember how he answered it? Yeah, there's a continuity of moments of consciousness. There's a continuity of moments of a similar type of the object as well. So probably it'd be interesting to know, and it may be different for each person, and maybe even different at different times, how many moments of the object and how many moments of exposure to the consciousness is necessary for us to register that there's an object, that we're engaging, apprehending an object. Yeah. So this is where Namperdue quotes Lhari Rinpoche's mind in Tibetan Buddhism as a source to prove that sense consciousnesses are not dumb consciousnesses, after all. So they don't merely register sensory input, but they are non-mistaken knowers. They're cognizing. They're active. They're free of conceptuality. Therefore, they do not name or classify their objects or reflect upon them like a determinative knower would. They merely experience their object, like a mirror. I like this explanation or this analogy that something comes. Well, that, I don't know if that works, because that kind of seems like that supports the dumb aspect. Something comes in front of the consciousness, it just knows the object. It just reflects the object. It takes on the aspect of that object. All discursive thought about the object observed by a sense-direct perceiver is done by later moments of conceptual consciousness induced by that consciousness. And that's because we have this predisposition for naming and categorizing and making connections, associations. So these sense consciousnesses may induce conceptuality, but they are free of conceptuality. So this is where he goes into talking about how sense consciousness can be trained such that an eye consciousness can know not only that a person being seen is a man, but also that that person is one's father or brother or friend, which then induce a subsequent conceptual consciousness that affixes the name, remembers associations, determines types, and so forth without any intervening reflection. It requires a lot of thought. Specifically characterized phenomena appear nakedly to direct perception. However, we don't perceive them nakedly because the object exists in a continuum of a similar type. I guess when he says nakedly, he's talking about just one bare moment. So the object exists in this continuum of a similar type. You find that term a lot. And we also have these predispositions for doing conceptual things like naming, labeling. And as you brought up earlier, sense consciousness do not simply register sensory input, but are even capable of knowing their object's ability to perform a function. So the last sharing, offering service Saturday, three of us were down at the fire pit at Tara's Refuge, and we were staring at the fire and trying to, it was just after we'd covered this section, and we were trying to observe the function of burning. Yeah, that's a sense direct perception for sure. Yeah. It's funny. I thought it had to be an eye consciousness, but it doesn't. Yeah. Yeah. Of course we can know it's burning. So tactile consciousness knows that. Thank you.
So I'm having trouble with the eye or visual consciousness knowing a function, like fire is hot and burns is the function. But it doesn't label. I don't quite understand that.
Yeah, it's difficult. In that situation, Venerable Losong was just suggesting maybe it's not the eye consciousness, maybe it's the tactile consciousness that knows the function of burning, because it has a direct experience. You can't experience that.
He does say eye consciousness.
He does. Okay, he says eye consciousness. Good, okay. You can watch a fire and see a log burn, right? It's disintegrating due to fuel being consumed. We can observe that with our visual consciousness. Are we finished? Is it time to go? Time to sing the song? Almost finished. 5 more minutes. Yeah, this is talking, I think, about a very subtle aspect of the visual consciousness. Thanks for pointing out that it does say visual consciousness. So this is something we just need to experiment with. And see if you can, we haven't covered that many definitions yet. We have the definitions of the four elements, hot and burning. Burning is the function. Wet and moistening. Can you see moistening? Hard and obstructive. Can you see obstruction? Probably we can.
We learned that the elements were apprehended as tangible objects, so it's the body sense consciousness that knows them.
Isn't that inconvenient? Okay. General Tarva says there were different viewpoints on it. But, yeah, in that, hot is definitely a tangible. Does it necessarily mean that the function is a tangible object? Hot and burning is the definition of fire. Hot is definitely something we can sense with our hot, burning. Yeah, I don't know.
Well, when we were at the fire pit, we could tell the air was hot because of the way that it looked with the difference in air pressure. So, but we're not necessarily seeing hot. We're just seeing
a change.
A change in the air. Mm-hmm. The pressure density of the air was different than the surrounding air. So we labeled it hot, but I don't know if that was visual consciousness or mental consciousness in that.
Is this something that the consciousness can come to know, just like knowing Father?
Again, I go to animals that don't speak. I mean, the deer that were fleeing the fire, in all the animals that were fleeing that fire, know hot and know burning and know its function and got the heck out of there if they could, right, without ever labeling or naming or, you know, having to have much conceptual thought about it. Their direct perception.
Yeah, but would it have been a tactile perception or would it have been a visual, olfactory smelling? Yeah, probably all the above. Combination of information coming in. Yeah, it's interesting. I don't have anything else to offer on that. Okay. Just one last thing at the bottom of page 222. I like what he said here. A sense consciousness does not conceive that its object is one's father, but it may induce a conceptual consciousness that affixes names, determines type, remembers association, and so forth. In this way, people are drawn into conceptuality, quickly abandoning the richness of direct perception in favor of mental imagery. I think that's something to underline. It's just a habit of the mind, isn't it, that we immediately go to thinking about something. And, you know, just sitting down to a meal and noticing how little of the experience we actually get in terms of taste, because the mind takes us into conception. So this is part of our practice of mindfulness and being present with what we're doing. And any of you who've done those 10-day Vipassana retreats, or maybe other retreats too, know that food never tastes so good as when you're on retreat, right? Because you're so present with it. You know, you slow down enough to really be present with the taste, as well as visual images and other sense objects. That's why we season food. What are you saying?
I'm not sure now I can form the whole. You said the experience of taste quite limited in our case.
Because we go right into conceptuality.
Yeah. Even we add a lot of, mixing a lot of stuff, like adding apple butter to cottage cheese and granola and what else? Raisins. Dry plums and such, and still it's not enough. Just enjoy the cottage cheese itself.
Uh huh. Yeah, It's similar to people who come to the Abbey and think that the food is going to be extremely bland and not very tasty because we don't use onion and garlic, when actually you really get to taste the flavor of the vegetables and other things, grains. Yeah. Okay, so we'll finish there. And it looks like next week we can finish up what Venerable has already taught. So we'll start with mental consciousness on page 223 and probably go all the way up to 234 where she finished.